From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning. I'm Larry Mantle. Bipartisan tributes are being paid to Arizona U.S. Senator John McCain. He died Saturday in Sedona, a day after his family announced the nearly 82-year-old was foregoing further treatment for a brain tumor. His more than 30 years in the Senate included major legislation on campaign spending and immigration. We remember the senator today on Air Talk.
KBCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, offering rebates for solar water heating. It works with a customer's existing natural gas water heater to offer reliable and efficient hot water. Invite the strength of the sun into your home or business. Info at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're doing great on this Monday morning and that you had a very nice weekend. We have so much to talk about in politics over the course of this hour on Air Talk. And of course, we remember John McCain, the late Arizona senator, more than 30 years in office and a remarkable life before he even arrived in politics. Throughout the course of our 2 hours, we will be remembering John McCain. And in our second hour, we'll open up the phones for you to share some of your favorite memories of John McCain. That's in the second hour of the program. But there's bipartisan tributes and grieving associated with the death Saturday of John McCain. He's close to turning 82. On Friday, his family announced he would be receiving no further medical treatment. Then Saturday, he died at his home in beautiful Sedona. A Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer had this to say about the passing of his colleague.
He was a true patriot. He loved the country. He loved the military. He loved the Senate. And maybe most important of all, he was always willing to speak truth to power at a time when there are so few people who do that. He will be so missed. Nothing will replace his memory, but I will be introducing a resolution into the Senate to rename the Russell Building after John McCain so that future generations who work there and future generations throughout America will remember him.
Joining me to remember John McCain and then to talk about other major political issues of the past few days, Democratic strategist Matt Rodriguez, former senior Obama advisor in 2008. And also our pleasure to welcome to the program as part of our political roundup on Monday from Pepperdine University, assistant dean and lecturer in the School of Public Policy, Carson Bruno, who's also former research fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institute. Carson, welcome.
Thank you.
Good to have you with us. Matt, let me start with you because given the bipartisan tributes to John McCain, I'd like to start with the Democrat and the significance of his life in public service.
Yeah, a long, very long and impressive life, long and impactful life. What you know, with all the medical issues that you went through, every time I've read his stories, worked for Obama in 08, sort of knew the book on him. But every time I read it, you come back to it every few months. What he went through at the Hanoi Hilton and in Vietnam is just unbelievable. The broken limbs, the torture, the psychological. And to have had such a, one, to have lived as long as he did, and then two, to have had what an impact that he had. It's very similar almost to Bob Dole. If you read some of the stuff Bob Dole went through in World War II, it was really rough stuff. I mean, he was really hurt. And gave almost that last full measure, as they say, on the battlefield. And to have had as long a life as he did, as an impactful life, is enormously impressive. He's, when you're a political junkie, you read things like Richard Hofstadter. And there's a chapter from his American political tradition. Every AP history student who's out there listening probably knows it. But he talks about Lincoln, about how inaccessible in a lot of ways Lincoln has become, because he's become a sort of Christ-like figure. He took all the sins of the country on, of slavery and the Civil War, and it was in that. And it's hard to sort of get who actually Lincoln was. There's an element of that going on with McCain right now. He was a more complicated man than we're hearing. He had some ups and some downs. He made some mistakes. We're in that kind of sort of deification mode right now. And some of it's deserved, some of it's not deserved. But he was an enormously impressive and impactful figure in our politics that I think – and I think his – reputation and his work will live on for a long time in a way that most senators do not.
Carson, your thoughts on John McCain's political legacy?
You know, it's interesting. So we just finished up our new student orientation at Pepperdine School of Public Policy, and I do a political policy trivia on the last night of that with the students. And one of the rounds is campaign slogans. Of course, choosing from kind of iconic campaign slogans. And of course, John McCain's 2008 campaign slogan of Country First really, I think, encapsulates not only what the message was he was trying to get across with his presidential campaign in 2008, but really his entire political legacy, both as a veteran, but then also as a politician in the U.S. Senate. And it really goes to this idea of really putting the best of the country first and always possible, really making sure that he is really trying to present what he really feels like is the American legacy in every way possible, not just what is the best for the party, but really ultimately what is the best for the country. And we really see that in his ask of former presidents Barack Obama and George W. Bush to be the ones who provide the eulogies for his funeral.
Very pointedly, exactly. Choosing to exclude President Trump.
Well, you know, it's the two men who beat him for the White House. So I think there's a little bit of the irony there that I think McCain always had a sense of that sort of irony within his legacy. But also, I think it really goes to kind of go back to this country first mentality that these are the people he ultimately respected, even though they had major policy differences both on the Republican side and the Democratic side.
Yeah,
I interviewed John McCain on several occasions in studio. Coming up in the second hour, I'll share some of my memories off mic of John McCain. And I also have a clip. I had completely forgotten about this when he caught me by surprise in an interview that I was doing during one of our member drives. I'm going to share that with you coming up in the second hour of Air Talk. He was a man who could definitely surprise you from time to time. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. And again, in the second hour, we open up the phones for you to share your memories of John McCain. Matt, you said, some of this isn't deserved, you said, in terms of and we do go through this period of immediately after a death, remember, particularly for someone such a unique figure as John McCain.
Yeah.
You feel comfortable sharing a couple of your qualms about him, particularly being part of the opposite campaign in 08.
Well, I think, and it's not as much a criticism of him. It's just to say that everyone has a complicated legacy. And you're
especially in politics.
I've never loved when people become completely deified simply because the nature of politics is working. You are beholden to the culture and the times of what's happening. Politics in some ways moved on from John McCain. It has changed greatly. And so I think you don't look, I don't like when they say, well, if everyone were just like John McCain, we'd all be better off.
Which would be impossible.
And it wouldn't be, you couldn't be a John McCain without the kind of run of the mill type of politics that you live in. But he did, look, he had some challenges. This is a guy, there was the Keating Five scandal that he got caught up in during the savings and loan. It's not clear that he really did anything untoward, but it was a wealthy savings and loan guy named Charles Keating. He was an Arizona guy.
Based in Arizona.
And McCain was caught up in that. There were five senators. Four of them ended up resigning. There was a serious deal. There was a huge bailout. I think his vote for Iraq was just not going to look good over time. He eventually said that was probably a mistake. And the bottom line is, for all of him and some of his partisans talking about how he wanted to elevate politics, and I think he did believe that. I'm not criticizing him for that, but he was the guy who picked Sarah Palin.
Which he admitted later was a huge mistake.
And he did admit later, and I respect that. Again, we all make mistakes, but that is a big part of what's unleashed kind of this larger grievance politics. She was extremely she really walked up to the line on some of the stuff she was saying about Obama at the time, and she was really tapping into in a way that's nothing compared to what Trump has done now, but it was really a forerunner to what we've seen in terms of really pushing on some of this racial stuff and some of the divisive issues to really gin up the parts of the base. And how much do you sort of pull that kind of George Wallace type of campaigning? We hadn't seen a lot of that as overtly in a long time. Palin started that, and Trump has really taken it to the other level. And I think McCain holds some responsibility for that, to be honest.
Do you think that had he not chosen Palin, that Senator Obama might not have been elected president?
No, I don't think so. I think Obama was going to win no matter what, having on that campaign. I think Palin hurt McCain, and I think it hurt his reputation a little bit for a while, which he's obviously rebounded from. But at the end of the day, look, George W. Bush was polling in the high 20s, low 30s. It was, other than Truman, it was historically low ending to a presidency. It's very difficult to win three terms in a row. Look, we saw that with Bill Clinton when Al Gore couldn't win. Bill Clinton was quite popular. Gore couldn't get over the top against a decent but not an overwhelming candidate in George W. Bush. Same thing with Hillary Clinton. She couldn't get over the top against Trump coming off of relatively popular Obama presidency, all relatively. And I think that – I just think at the end of the day he wasn't going to win. I think the difference was too great. People were looking for change. There was a contrast between the ages between the two. So, no, I don't – and Obama really was a phenomenon in 2008. It feels like a long time ago now. But, no, I don't think he would have won. But I do think the Palin move was a mistake.
The sense of destiny sort of about the whole Obama.
It was overwhelming everybody in 2008.
So, Carson Bruno, your thoughts on what you see as a mixed political legacy of McCain.
Oh, definitely. I mean, yes, there's definitely – issues that the left can come at him on, Iraq definitely being a key point there. Generally speaking, he was on the very hawkish side of the Republican Party.
But he could be critical of the Pentagon at the same time.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I think that really goes to speak to who John McCain was as an elected official in the greatest sense of the word, in that he was a maverick. I mean, in a lot of different ways. He poked the conservative side of the Republican Party just as much as he was poking the progressive side of the Democratic Party. And that really makes him a unique figure within the American political system, especially today, where you have a lot of just kind of stacking and it's resorting of the two parties, and not so much variation within the parties and within the members themselves, both at the Senate level and at the congressional level. And so there's going to be a lot, I think, of unpacking from his legacy, and a lot of trying to figure out exactly what was he thinking at different points in time when he was trying to make these decisions. Sarah Palin being an excellent example. What was he truly thinking? Yeah, we have game change. We have those accounts. But at the same time, now in retrospect, we can kind of really start to really, I think, really dive into deeper about what was his thought process and in those decisions that he made.
Yeah, and I don't want to be overly negative. There's not a lot of greatness in our political figures ever, really. I mean, because we're all flawed people. There actually was a greatness in John McCain that I think people recognize, and I do want to acknowledge that.
No, I didn't hear what you're saying is writing him down.
Well, I think his greatness was, but to get back to some of it, actually goes back to his flaws and not so much his successes, which is what I thought made McCain a great man in a lot of ways was his ability to grow and to change continually. He lived a long time. After the Keating Five scandal, he determined, I'm not going to have my integrity questioned again. And he made campaign finance, which he really believed in, worked with Russ Feingold, Carson talking about working with people across the aisle. And so that was a piece of it. I think he did come to say Iraq might have been a mistake in some form, at least going in there. So the piece on Palin, he was always growing as a candidate and growing as an elected official. You saw it with him not voting for the Obamacare repeal. He knew where he wanted to stand and he was willing to go there. And I think that is really sort of the greatness. The bipartisanship, some of that becomes that's important. But what was important was he was always willing to say, this is where I was and the past is what it was. But he was always moving forward, and that's an important element to any elected official.
He succeeded Barry Goldwater as senator. Goldwater had had a very long tenure, McCain over 30 years. And I think of this sort of Arizona political environment in which Barry Goldwater, a libertarian Republican, gets completely blasted in the 64 presidential election, but he's really the standard bearer for that strain of conservatism. Mm-hmm. Then, and you have Sandra Day O'Connor of the Supreme mm-hmm. Court, who, she sort of goes her own way, and she's the one who's not necessarily predictable when you're going to get a close decision among the justices. Carson Bruno, your thoughts about, where he fits in this sort of Arizona tradition?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, the Goldwater era, Goldwater legacy really kind of then transforms into the Reagan legacy and the Reagan era. Mm-hmm. And really that has been the modern Republican movement. Arguably now you can start to say that it's starting to break down. And what will that actually look like moving forward? It's still way too early to really determine because we don't really have someone of that stature really standing up and really starting to take fold of the party the way that Goldwater first did, that then became Reagan, and then really everyone else has been trying to
relive Reagan's.
Well,
and they're ideological.
Yes.
Unlike, and Trump really isn't an
absolutely.
Ideological
absolutely.
President, which sort of leaves the party like, well, then post-Trump, what are we?
What are we? Exactly. And that's the big question mark. What are we? And when you don't have statesmen like John McCain or others really kind of stepping up to kind of fill that void, it does become become, you know, a little bit of a flashpoint. You start to see these really these big battles between, you know, will Mitt Romney be in the Senate, you know, in a few years? What will his role end up being? Will he kind of take up that mantle, or will he kind of fall in line with kind of whatever the rank and file activists are pushing? You see it on the Democratic side too. So, I mean, I think that right now we're having this conversation because, you know, Trump is in the White House, because, you know, John McCain just passed. But these are the same questions that the Democrats are trying to figure out as well. What does the future of the party look like? It is a Sanders movement, or is it something along the moral lines of a Clinton?
I think what's different about on the Democratic side is you have sort of clearer ideological frameworks. On the Republican side, you've got the sort of, you know, Reaganism, or the more libertarian strain. You've got evangelical conservatives, and then you've got Trump, which isn't, and it's sort of, you know, where you know, what are you coalescing around?
Yeah, and I think the Republicans have. I think Republicans, in a lot of ways, what's uniting them is their grievance. You know, even when it's grievance around identity, grievance around the mainstream media. I mean, Republicans hold power at every single level in terms of Congress, in terms of the presidency. They are stacking the judiciary with very young judges. Trump is the one thing Trump has been very competent and very methodical about is actually putting judges on, both on the Supreme Court, especially if he gets Kavanaugh through, as well as the district and circuit courts. Yet even when you'll talk to Republicans, even friends of mine are Republicans, the minute something will come out, I was saying something about Ocasio-Cortez. She's been getting a little bit the woman who beat Joe Crowley, and she's been getting a little bit of criticism for not really knowing exactly some of her facts and what she talks about. And immediately it was like, well, Sarah Palin, she doesn't get treated anywhere near as badly as Sarah Palin. So it's like somehow there's a huge conspiracy against Republicans, even though they can, if you look at a map, the map is all red in the country. And so I think what's holding them together a lot of ways is everyone is somehow against us. And somehow the Republicans, we'll see what happens in November, but they've gotten away with this kind of like, oh my goodness, everyone is against us, even though they hold power at almost every single level of government.
And I want to hear Carson's response to that as we continue, but I do need to break. That's Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, Rodriguez Strategies, his Los Angeles-based firm, former senior advisor to then-Senator Obama in his presidential campaign of 2008. We've been talking about the man who was his opponent in the 2008 presidential election, the late John McCain. Also with us, Pepperdine University Assistant Dean in the School of Public Policy, Carson Bruno. He also lectures there and was for a number of years at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. We'll continue with much more in the way of politics right after this. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We were just talking through the break about our shock when we found out Sarah Palin was named the running mate of John McCain. And as we found out later, he rather quickly realized he was in for a tough go in that presidential election. We're remembering John McCain. And of course, this is politics, and the world goes on despite the passing of Senator McCain, and that means filling his senatorial seat for the remaining 2 years of the term. Arizona's governor will be making that selection. Carson, I wanted to hear, you know, first of all, your response to what Matt was saying about sort of the identity politics characterization.
Well, it's absolutely true. I mean, Republicans have taken on identity politics, but at the same time, Democrats are the ones who perfected identity politics in many sense of the word. And so Republicans are now just seeing it as a winning strategy and are moving toward that direction. Is it good for the country? Probably not.
Very bad.
You don't want to pit neighbor against neighbor at any level of politics, but it seems that's where we're going. And it'll be interesting to see after the midterm elections kind of whether a strategy it differs, you know, depending on what happens with the House particularly.
Well, and I think what's interesting about that, we talk about John McCain, and it's interesting watching so many of the tributes pour, right? We need bipartisanship. We need more people like John McCain. But fundamentally, right now, at least the basis of the party, that's not what they want. They actually don't, even the people who are pouring in tribute saying, well, what was great, they want bipartisanship to them is if you agree with me 100% of the time. So they expect Republicans to act like Democrats and vice versa. And that's kind of where our politics are. It's a very unyielding. We talked about this last week.
Yeah, sort of it's not about moderating to find some sort of compromise.
No, like McCain is not that is not what either party wants. And you see it on both sides. If Democrats sort of move a little bit, whether you should abolish ICE or not, they're immediately attacked. Someone will say, no, I think that's a bad idea. That's immediately an attack. And they're not a real Democrat. You're seeing it with the race against Feinstein and De Leon. Mm-hmm. These are real attacks on saying there's not fealty. And if you ever compromise, that is by definition negative, even though our entire system of government is based on compromise. So that's and that's what I meant by politics sort of moving on from McCain, not dissimilar to Ted Kennedy. Ted Kennedy knew the role that he played. He knew that he was a boogeyman, but he knew that when he got into the back room that he could make a deal. And that's why people wanted to work with Ted Kennedy, despite whatever. He knew that the campaign ads are going to be against him and they were going to run and say, oh, we've got to go and stop the Ted Kennedys of the world. But he was genuinely a good legislator and people knew that. And it was a similar aura around McCain. But that's not really what our politics want right now, despite everyone talking about that.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
You also have to be careful that, kind of putting compromise on this pedestal. A lot of times compromise can lead to really bad policy. Matt, you brought up McCain-Feingold, the campaign finance reform. There could be a lot of very good arguments that actually was very terrible policy at the end of the day, in how it was implemented, but also how it was thought up. And ultimately that came around because of compromise.
But I think for many Americans, the issue isn't that everything has to be a compromise, because we do have elections with consequences, of course, but that when there's never compromise, that's toxic. And McCain-Feingold, I think, is a great example. No one really knows what a sweeping piece of legislation like that is going to do in the real world once it's implemented. Mm-hmm. So I think the ideal is when you see what the problems with it are, ideally you come back together and find, as opposed to each party finding how can they demonize this thing, run from it, and make it appear it's some evil created by the other party. I think that's what we don't see.
And look, like with all things, politics has become more sophisticated for better, but I think for a lot of ways for worse. And when you have a 24/7 media and you have a 24/7 campaign, you have money flowing in and out, whether it's big money or even small money, but there's a premium and there's a business to constantly roiling both sides. There's a benefit to having enough retweets, having enough likes, how am I trending, how much money am I making? And so this has just changed over time, and politics has never been perfect, and it's always been kind of an ugly business. I've never been into things are so horrible now, but it is different than what I think people are saying about McCain. We're not going to go back to what McCain was. He was a unique point in time. And it's a larger selfie culture. It's a much more focused on us culture. And McCain came from just after that World War II generation, but before the boomers. And so he had a much larger sense of I am doing things for a larger good or a larger reason. And that sort of always instilled his ethic. We're in a different place right now culturally, and I just don't think that Americans think that way. It's just different.
Let's go back to Doug Ducey, the Arizona governor's choice that he has here. Looking at the type of Republican as well as the specific individual, Carson, what do you think he should most consider in the choice?
There's a lot. There's a lot to consider for him politically, and then also for the state politically. He's in the midst of his own reelection, so he needs to really be considerate of that. His appointments really kind of influence then his chances for reelection in November. Does he wait? Does he hold off and just kind of wait to see what happens with the open Senate seat that Jeff Flake is retiring from? Also then, does he wait to see if he gets reelected or not? And then maybe he can appoint in the lame ducks situation if he is unfortunate enough not to get reelected. But then also you have 2020. His appointment will have to stand for election in 2020 if it is someone who decides not to be a placeholder and then has to then run for a reelection again in 2022. So there's a lot of different elements to that, 2020 being a presidential election, Trump being up for reelection. Trump did not do well in Arizona in 2016. Yes, he won it, but he only won it with 48-49% of the vote compared to the 54% that both McCain and Romney got in their election. So there's a lot of different elements here about how does he maintain the conservative base, which is very, very vibrant in Arizona, while also recognizing the fact that Arizona might be shifting politically.
Yeah, and as you say, isn't quite as Trump friendly. So is the smart thing for him politically then to look at someone who isn't as Trump aligned, but who has very strong conservative credentials?
My guess is yes. Also remember, I think age is also an important thing here. You know, they were talking about John Kyle. Is he a placeholder? Former senator from Arizona, longtime senator. Cindy McCain, it sounds like she's probably not going to be in the mix. So that's the latest I'm hearing. I don't know. But they're older, so that they're probably not a long-term solution. And so do you want a kind of younger, conservative, you know, late 30s, 40s, even 50, but someone who might be there for 20 or 30 years. And then I think, you know, the Trump thing, we don't know where all this Trump kind of is going to go, not just winning in 2020 or what happens, but also just what his impact is going to be on the party. So Ducey's got, we'll only know in hindsight what was or was not a good choice. In a place like Arizona, you probably want someone fairly conservative with some kind of independent streak and probably younger is my guess, which is the way they should or want to go. Now, what the bench looks like in Arizona. I mean, we're talking about Cindy McCain and John Kyle, so I don't know what kind of younger bench that they have, but that's the direction I would think you'd want to go in if you could.
They're sort of politically, it would avoid too much criticism from the right and not cost him votes if he did this before November.
Not cost him votes.
From Democrats.
Yeah, and hopefully that, again, if it's a placeholder, then you're just in the same place in 2 years, right? So then you just got, and then you got to maybe go through an ugly primary, and ideally if you have someone conservative enough, they can keep a primary from happening in 2020, and then you run whatever the Democrat's going to be, and we'll see what the 2020 atmospherics are at that
Carson,
point.
Carson, what do you think?
Yeah, I definitely think – I don't think a placeholder approach would probably be the best given the political environment in Arizona, again, for those reasons. You don't want to have a primary like the Republicans are having right now with McSally versus Dr. Ward versus Sheriff Joe, really causing a lot of division within the party in a state that they don't need divisions right now. And so it makes sense for Governor Ducey to – appoint someone who plans to run for re-election and someone who can withstand not actually creating a primary situation.
And it makes sense for Trump. He's not going to want instability in that state when he's running because that is an increasingly Latino electorate there. And as Carson mentioned, that state is getting closer as some of the states in the Southwest are. At some point, they're potentially more purple than they are red. And so, you know, some kind of – now, how acutely the Trump folks are looking at this, I don't know. But you probably don't want too much of a divisive primary in 2020, which could cause turnout problems in the general. And if everything holds the way we think, Trump is going to need every last vote everywhere that he can get.
Yeah. So as we hear it, this is not an easy decision.
No, there's a lot of strategic thought to go into it.
We're talking with Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, Pepperdine University Assistant Dean, the School of Public Policy. Carson Bruno with us as well. We talk about John McCain's legacy is, also talking about the potential successor via appointment of Governor Ducey in Arizona. I want to quickly, before we break, talk about the son or daughter of NAFTA, if you will. Mm-hmm. President Trump saying an understanding's been reached to replace NAFTA, and it does not include Canada at this point. This U.S.-Mexico trade agreement doesn't have a lot of specifics of what's included in it. But, Carson, your thoughts, and might this be something that's a win for President Trump getting a better deal for the U.S.?
We definitely need something that he ran on the campaign touting, NAFTA definitely being something that he ran very hard against on the campaign. And so he needs something to really show his base that he has been doing something on that regard. He is, again, President Trump has always said that he's the best negotiator in the room. And so he needs something to really highlight the fact that he is in fact, the best negotiator in the room. And thus far, we really don't have too much to back that up. So this definitely could end up being a win for him as in the White House, particularly. But the big question is, will congressional Republicans go along with it? And within the congressional Republican caucuses, both in the House and the Senate, you still have a very, very, very pro-trade, generally pro-NAFTA caucus there. And so they're going to be really kind of paying attention to what the details of this are, whether Canada is involved in it or not, which will be, I think, an important situation for them. You already have Senator Hatch really saying that Canada should be a part of whatever agreement is struck with Mexico. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's going to be a definitely a potential tripping block for the Trump White House.
We're going to continue with more on politics. I mean, it's sort of ironic that, you know, coming after the disastrous week for President Trump last week, which we will get into, then the announcement of this next generation of NAFTA. Just received word that California Senator Dianne Feinstein will be joining us live in our second hour to talk about John McCain, and former U.S. Senator Barbara Boxer will also be with us live. We'll talk with both of them coming up. We'll play excerpts of one or more of my multiple interviews with Senator McCain. In fact, I think it was the first interview I did with him is included in my book. I excerpted because I was so happy with how that conversation went. It's in the book that I wrote a few years ago. This is Air Talk, 20 Years of Conversation. So I had a chance to talk with him many times over the years, hung out with him off the air here at KPCC, waiting to go on. I'll share some of those memories coming up in the second hour as well. It's Air Talk on 89.3, back after a live update from Hedy Lyn Herdes. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle with Carson Bruno of Pepperdine University, where he's the assistant dean of the School of Public Policy. As you probably know, Pete Peterson, the dean of the School of Public Policy, joins us regularly. It's wonderful to have his colleague Carson Bruno with us for the first time. And Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist of Rodriguez Strategies in L.A., former senior Obama advisor in 08. Well, a disastrous week for President Trump last week, the conviction on multiple counts of Paul Manafort, his personal attorney, Michael Cohen, pleading guilty to an array of charges, including one involving campaign contributions, as the charge puts it, money paid to Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal to avoid them going public with their stories of affairs they said that they had with Donald Trump. We also have the financial head of the Trump Organization and the publisher of the National Enquirer reportedly having immunity in exchange for what they know about President Trump and the campaign's activities. Carson, couldn't have been much worse of a week for the president.
Let's go back and talk about John McCain. Is that possible, Larry?
Yeah. No,
not definitely not a good week. You could see it definitely in his resurgence of late night tweeting, that his frustration, I think, on especially, I think, the Michael Cohen component, because that is someone I think he trusted as a friend, a confidant, someone in his corner for a very long time. And to see him flip so aggressively and so quickly, I really think really got to the personal side of President Trump. There's a few things. I mean, there's a lot to unpack here, obviously. I don't think we have enough time to really unpack everything. But what is really interesting is, you know, the focus since the day of the election basically has been on Russia, 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 influence, influence, foreign influence. And what we're really seeing with the Mueller probe and kind of what's happening actually within the legal system doesn't really have too much to do with Russia itself, if at all. So the Democrats have a hard time, are going to have, I think, an increasingly hard time to really kind of continue to push this Russia narrative when what's happening actually within the legal system isn't connected to Russia, but other issues, again, that are very problematic from a legal standpoint for the president and his people, but still not connected to that narrative that has been percolating and talked about for so long.
Do you see the Mueller probe with any parallels with the former dean of the law school, I believe, at Pepperdine, Ken Starr, with his and what begins as a real estate investigation into Whitewater ends up with, you know, lying under oath, mm-hmm. and it ultimately leads to the impeachment of President Clinton. You see any parallels where it starts with one thing and then becomes something?
Absolutely. I mean, in any sort of investigations of this nature, kind of what is the initial spark of the investigation. Typically, it's not ultimately what's gets the man or woman. You think about Al Capone. I mean, he wasn't taken down for all the things that he did. He was taken down for tax evasion at the end of the day. And so a lot of similarities again, with the Clinton era, starting off with one thing and ending up of what is the definition of is, very, very vastly different. And I think that's often the problem that individuals who are swept up in these investigations, they get so focused on one point and then really forget to kind of see the bigger picture of what else might trip them up.
Yeah. And of course, it doesn't mean there isn't all this malfeasance everywhere you look. We talked about this last week, Matt.
This has been the challenge. This really goes back to Watergate, which is, you had the independent counsel statute coming out of Watergate. You were trying to keep Archibald Cox at the time, who'd gotten fired in the Saturday Night Massacre. And so this has been happening off and on, which is how large of a mandate do you give to these prosecutors? And a lot of people thought Kenneth Starr got way far afield. It got out of control. If you go looking for every single thing, something similar is happening now. They've kind of tweaked the independent counsel statute. So how protected is Mueller? How is he not? So this has been something that really has been a legacy of Watergate now going on more than 40 years, which is how do you investigate potential wrongdoing at the top of the chain of the United States government, the executive branch, while at the same time not completely hobbling the president's ability to do work or completely getting out of control or spending taxpayer dollars and going in all sorts of different directions. I don't think that's been resolved. I don't think it will ever be resolved because there's always going to be a kind of give and take of, how much should you be investigating? And if you find crimes, what do you do? It's kind of must be funny. Guys like a Cohen and Manafort, had Trump not won, and I don't think Trump really thought he was going to win, none of this would have been a problem. It wasn't that Manafort, what he did wasn't illegal. Just no one really cared. And so now what you're doing is you're seeing a kind of seedy underbelly in the types of people that Trump has been hanging around with. He has always said a red line is his business empire. It's hard to imagine some of the stuff that we're seeing coming out of the Cohens and the Rick Gates and Manafort, and that it's not going to extend to a lot of corner cutting in his business area, which might go not only to him, but to his kids. And so I think the big political question to me is really, obviously, how do Republicans and Democrats deal with this?
Yeah.
Although I think they're just going to let this play out. But how does Trump deal with this? Is he going to try to fire Sessions? Is he going to try to fire Mueller? At some point, as this gets closer, how much of a desperate, cornered animal does he become?
Well, and Carson, then, this going to put it right in the lap of Republicans. Mm-hmm. What do they do?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, what do they do? If you think back to Watergate, which is a lot, there are, some similarities between Watergate and what's happening right now. You see that the Republicans really stuck with President Nixon at that time for quite some time.
2 years.
Right.
It took 2 years. Yeah. It was not right away.
And it wasn't really until truly the political capital started to kind of fall out from underneath the Republican Party and Republicans individually for their own prospects of re-election and keeping any sort of power that they may have in Washington, D.C. Right now, you're not seeing that. The latest Gallup poll has President Trump at 86% approval rating with Republicans, not all too different from what President Obama had at this point in time with Democrats in his presidency. So you're not seeing the rank and file abandoning the president quite yet. And therefore, you really won't see, I think, congressional leaders or the congressional members start to abandon their president at this point. However, the question is, if or when do the rank and file Republicans start to kind of move away from the president, at which point then Republicans in Congress will have a lot of decision making to do.
Well, and what's your sense of what would cause Republicans to fall away from the president? Probably not paying, the two women to keep that story quiet. It doesn't seem like that's, a cause of great concern. So, what would it be that would reach that threshold, do you think?
It's hard to say, for someone who grew up as a Republican and is a conservative, there's a lot of what has already been talked about is quite goes against the grain for kind of what traditional Republicans and traditional conservatives are all about. The Russian influence situation, Putin himself in that situation. Of course, there's a lot of family values issues at the heart of the Stormy Daniels payments and Playboy payments. So the fact that Republicans thus far have kind of stuck with the president might lend some credence to this idea of this Teflon nature that Trump has developed with his own branding. So it's kind of hard to say what might actually be the straw that break the camel's back in this situation. ultimately it may be losing the House in November, mm-hmm. and whether then that kind of puts the Republicans out of control of all three branches.
Even though that would be expected for a midterm election anyway, that still, if that happens, so jarring for Republicans. Matt, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's going to be challenging for people to move away from Trump because he's got something that is hard to pull off, is that even though he's president, has been there for a couple of years, he still feels like an outsider. I mean, so many candidates are, Jimmy Carter did this, Obama did this, Clinton did this. But within a year or two, you pretty much own, you bought it, you own it. But Trump bought it and has never really owned it. And I think that, and it gets back to what we were talking about earlier, this little bit of the grievance piece, the fact that Trump is willing to just go out there and still stick it to people that the media or Hollywood or, I think there's a few sacred cows that he's willing to go after. And that, to his supporters and to a large part of the Republican Party, that is just intoxicating. And that has worked. And I, when they're going to move away from that, I'm not sure. It's different than it was in the 70s. People started moving away from Nixon when it was clear that there was wrongdoing. I'm not sure. So many people have baked into the cake the Trump that he's not a good guy. Even the people who support him, you've seen just thousands of interviews of people saying, I don't like what he does here or there, but I like that. If people are upset with him,
questioning his character. Because that 86% includes a lot of people that question the president's character.
Exactly. But they'll sit there and say, like, if he's causing this much problem and this much Sturm und Drang, there must be something going right. I think that's the lens that a lot of the Republican voters see, which is like, if everyone's upset at him, he must be doing the right thing. And so I think it's going to be hard to move away from him. Now, the politics could change with the House changing, but I don't know if it's going to change with the voters for a while.
All right. We'll continue our conversation and definitely want to hear what Matt has to say about the change in the rules of the first ballot vote at the convention on DNC superdelegates. We're going to talk about that. Of course, this was very controversial in the last Democratic National Convention. We'll also talk about the confirmation hearings, which get underway a week from tomorrow for Supreme Court nominee Judge Kavanaugh. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Every Monday, we get together with the smartest folks in politics to hear what they have to say about the biggest political developments of the past few days. We're joined by Carson Bruner of Pepperdine University. He's Assistant Dean of the School of Public Policy, and Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist. Matt, I wanted to ask you about the change in rules for the voting at the Democratic National Convention. Superdelegates not going to be included on the first ballot. What's the significance of this?
Yeah, it's sort of complicated, as you might imagine. A lot of this comes out of the Sanders push, which a lot of his supporters were upset that, because what happens is you have to get a certain number of delegates, obviously, to win your party's nomination. And you win a proportional amount, or depending on each state, on how well you do. You get a certain amount of votes, and you get a proportional number. And so that's what you fight it out in the states for. But there's also the superdelegates, members of Congress, governors, certain DNC members who have an automatic vote. And they can decide at any time, I'm going to be a Hillary Clinton supporter or a Bernie Sanders supporter.
Publicly announce it.
And they do that a lot. There's a lot of courting and wooing of those delegates. And some of those reforms are also what came out of the 70s, sort of sunshine reforms. And it's a way to keep the party involved. This is still getting your party's nomination, which I think has been lost here a little bit, as opposed to just a complete free-for-all. It is there's some adherence to whatever the platforms and the party building that should be going on. So they've taken that away just on the first vote. So if somehow someone does not get enough votes to be nominated on the first one, then the superdelegates can come in and they can be pledged. So, and they get to vote on other parts of the platform on the first vote. It's just for the presidential candidate.
So is that more symbolic than practical?
Well, it depends. It's symbolic in that most of the time your presidential nominee has it wrapped up by the time you get to the – it's very rare you get to a convention and have a fight. So from that point of view, it's symbolic. But I also think it's symbolic of the weakening of the parties. Again, you talk about why some things can't get done politically or in Congress. Some of that is the weakening of the parties. And I'm not just a rah-rah party person, but this is one more example of people who have worked in the party for a long time and your typical different bases of support from elected officials or – DNC chairs of different states or members, that they have a certain ethic and a certain ideology that they bring. And some of this is sort of tearing that down by saying, well, we're getting more young people to participate in the process. But that's not a wholly perfect thing either.
Well, yeah, because presumably the people that are the superdelegates have, you know, kind of been through the wars and understand a bit of what's at play in the general election that other delegates may not.
And their job is to protect the party, which is ultimately what you are representing to the American people. And so this is going more in terms of a free-for-all in terms of the election itself and the primary season.
Now, but the GOP doesn't have superdelegates, do they, Carson?
Technically they do, actually. But they've never had the same amount of power and flexibility as on the Democratic side. And so they've been less of an issue, and it's really always kind of been down to, on the Republican side, whether it's a winner-take-all situation or a proportional situation on how the delegates are allocated based off of the primaries and the caucuses for the Republican candidates. So so they are there, but they're not – they've never had the sense of visibility and quote-unquote power that the Democrats have had on their side.
Next week, we start the confirmation hearing, the Senate Judiciary Committee, for Judge Kavanaugh to be the next justice of the Supreme Court. Carson, your thoughts about what we're going to be hearing next week?
Well, definitely, I mean, the issues, abortion, Roe v. Wade is going to be an important topic.
Presidential executive power.
Presidential executive powers. You know, there's been a lot that the Supreme Court has done in the last, you could say, 5 to 8 years that I think the Senate will be really focusing on kind of how would those decisions really kind of been affected if Kavanaugh had been on the bench at that point in time, and kind of what might have changed. You know, would the Roberts Court have upheld Obamacare if it was Kavanaugh versus someone else on the bench? So I think we'll get into a lot of those. As you're seeing with the Democrats, they are pushing this notion of where are the documents sort of deal, which I think is partially to kind of help insulate some of their more moderate red state Democrats who are up for election. Also, I think it's they're running into difficulty of just kind of trying to pin down where Kavanaugh might be and really trying to demonize him in a way that would speak to their base. Because at the end of the day, Kavanaugh is very, very respected jurist and someone who is more than qualified for the
bench.
Well,
he's been around, and it's not like he hasn't issued decisions. It's not like his point of view is some secret.
Yeah, I'll tell you what you're going to hear, Larry. You're going to hear a lot of, "Senator, I can't answer that question. I can't answer anything with a case that might come before me. I can tell you I'm going to follow the law." And since the Bork hearings and certainly the Bork and the Thomas hearings, that's pretty much what you get. And that's what you're going to hear. I think Carson's right. I think that they're trying to protect their moderate members a little bit. I don't know if they want a huge abortion fight or a couple of other fights that they're going to get into. I think they're obviously hoping for a silver bullet. But I think Democrats have known from the beginning that they just don't have the procedural – they don't have any of the chops to be able to stop this. And so how much do you want to fight on a losing battle while at the same time giving something to the base, which is extraordinarily upset and wants to go after him? Even though there's nothing they can really do to stop it, they feel like they should just be lying on the floor in the chamber, and somehow that will stop the vote.
So the Democrats who are going to be speaking Tuesday, it starts with the members of the Judiciary Committee making their statements, that we're just going to hear a lot of stuff that's really aimed at November.
Yeah. Yeah, you're going to hear a lot of messaging, and you're going to talk a lot about Trump. I think they're probably going to focus a lot on Trump and if he gets indicted. Can a president be indicted? You know, some of his writings around Kenneth Starr, and he'd worked on the independent counsel in the 90s. So I think they're going to go after that. And look, I think they're going to hope for something. What also makes this difficult is actually Trump. There's so much news every single day. It's difficult. You know, when the Bork thing happened, Ted Kennedy ran to the floor, attacked Bork. It was news for a long stretch. Right. Everyone was talking about it. People at the water cooler at work, like, my goodness, what's going on? It's hard to have an opinion on anything other than Trump because he sucks so much oxygen out of the room. And now while that's negative sometimes, there's a positive in that there's a lot of other work that they're able to do because there's just no bandwidth to say, oh, is Kavanaugh a good or a bad guy? At some point, I think people are just going to give in and vote for the guy and just move forward.
Absolutely. I mean, it's going to be a lot of inside ball game, which we're already seeing. And that just doesn't resonate outside of the Washington, D.C., you know, beltway. And so from an activist standpoint, from a rank and file standpoint, I don't think you're going to get much traction on this nomination. I think it's going to be rather close. I don't imagine it being vastly different than the 54-45 vote that Gorsuch got. And at the end of the day, we're going to have a full bench by the time November rolls around, most likely.
Hey, gentlemen, thanks so much. Great to have you with us. Thanks, appreciate it very much. Making his debut on the program and studios, part of this roundtable, Carson Bruno of Pepperdine University's Assistant Dean, School of Public Policy, Matt Rodriguez, a former senior Obama advisor in 08, and Rodriguez Strategies, his firm here in Los Angeles. Coming up, we'll talk with U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein. She remembers John McCain. Former U.S. Senator Barbara Boxer will be with us. We'll play some excerpts from my interviews with Senator McCain, that all coming up. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope your day is going well so far. Later this hour, we remember another man whose life ended over the weekend. Neil Simon passed away, the great playwright, screenwriter, arguably the most popular American playwright on Broadway. At one time, he had several theaters going with his remarkably popular shows. We'll remember him coming up later this hour, but the bulk of this hour we spend on remembering Arizona U.S. Senator John McCain, who passed away Saturday at his home in Sedona. He was diagnosed last year with glioblastoma, a brain tumor. He'd been under treatment for months. That treatment stopped on Friday. An announcement from the family came, and then he passed, surrounded by family members, those closest to him, on Saturday. Someone who knew him very well during many years serving together in the United States Senator, currently the senior senator from California, Dianne Feinstein. Senator, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Larry. Great to be here.
What are your most vivid memories of serving in the Senate with John McCain?
Well, I have two. One, I went to Guantanamo, to the prison facility there, which houses terrorist suspects. And coming home in the plane, we got into a discussion of his service. And I learned for the first time the depth and breadth of his suffering, but also about his sense of humor. And apparently when he was the five-year captive in the Hanoi Hilton, one of the things that he and other prisoners did was they worked out a tap code. It's like a Morse code. And they used it on the walls, and they could tap a message. And there in the plane, he began to tap. And he could tap and speak to the taps. So after all these years, he remembered that tap code. And I've seen it done one other time as well. I think he was very unusual as a man. I mean, obviously, his genes were in the military with the very prominent roles that his father and his grandfather played. But, he was also very honest about himself. He said, I was the lowest person at Annapolis. And when he went into the military, certainly wasn't back channel. He was flying a plane. He was shot down over Hanoi. He was taken prisoner. And all the rest is history. But how he has come out of it with the sense of humor, the strength of purpose, and I think the ability, one might say he has a command presence. Wherever he went, people knew, they listened, and they heard.
We're talking with U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein of California as she remembers her late Senate colleague, John McCain, who died on Saturday. Senator, did you work together on specific pieces of legislation across the aisle to do that?
Well, I'll tell you what we worked together on, and that was torture. While I was chairman of the Intelligence Committee, over a six-year period, we did a 32,000-page report on the interrogation program that went on involving potential terrorists, and for which a number of people are being held at Guantanamo as well as in other places. And he was head of the Armed Services Committee, and he one day said to me, I want to help with this, and I know what torture can do, and I know what it can't do, and it's wrong, and we shouldn't practice it. And so he, as chairman of the committee, got in a defense authorization bill, an explicit prohibition against the United States of America using torture. And I was very grateful for that because it had never been clear, and much was made politically of that fact as to whether it permitted some egregious practices or not. But I think the point is that he actually sought me out. He asked. He moved ahead. He got it done. And the United States will be better off because of it.
U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein, and we'll get back to her for that second anecdote in a moment. But I just wonder, one of the things about John McCain is that even though the majority of the time he would vote with his fellow Republicans, he would definitely go his own way at times also. Do you think it's possible for someone to be elected to the U.S. Senate today who doesn't conform a higher percentage of the time to the expectations of the party?
See, that's a real issue. It's a real problem. And I'm going to defer that question and try to think more, a little bit more about it.
Mm-hmm.
The Senate is a very different place than when I came to it. Can I give you one example?
Yeah, please.
Okay. When I was here for about 5-6 months, I ran into Joe Biden in the cloakroom, and it was Joe, as chairman of Judiciary, that asked me if I would be the first woman to go on the committee. And I did. And I decided I was going to carry out a long-standing interest of mine, which was an assault weapons bill. So we wrote the bill. We spent a lot of time on it. We prepared binders for everybody showing what kind of attacks they had in their state, if they did. And when I saw Joe, I said, Joe, I want you to know I'm going to do this on the crime bill. And he laughed at me. And he said, well, you're new here. And he said, wait till the gunners get to you. So I did do it on the crime bill. And in those days, cloture was not used to prevent a bill from going to the floor. And Bob Dole stood up. He was the minority leader. And he said, this is an important bill. It deserves to be debated on the floor of the United States Senate. And debate it we did. There was a motion to table. We won it by one vote. And then it went, I think we won the bill with 56 votes. It went to the House. Schumer did it. The Clinton administration got involved. It was very helpful. And the bill passed. Now, that bill, we have rewritten it. We've rewritten it after Sandy Hook, when you've had almost 200 additional school shootings in 5 years, with 400 children wounded, killed, including staff. And we've got, I think, 27, 28 co-sponsors, but we can't move the bill. That's the difference.
You just feel like there's and it's not just when it comes to gun control. You see this generally that there's not any sort of measures that both parties can agree on in the Senate.
Well, I think the parties have been much more caught up as of late in how do they win the election? How do they maintain control instead of what is right for the American people? How do we make this country safer? And when you run up against the fact that we're 4% of the world's population and we've got 40% of the guns of the world on our streets, that's a big problem.
We're talking. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So Senator McCain could see beyond all of the politics. And I think that perhaps the experience he had, which he so eloquently said, you know, I really grew to love America while I was a prisoner for 5 years in the Hanoi Hilton. And then he spoke about what his dream of America was, the kind of America that I think we would all want. And it's hard to carry out in a two-party system where you are often prevented from doing something you might want to do and be able to get something passed. So it's a bit of an irony that you have somebody that we're losing now that was so strong and so much able to go out as chair and get this bill through, which prohibited torture for the rest of time from being used in the United States of America, or by the United States, I should say, too. So his leadership, and no, we knew his past. We knew he was a Navy pilot. We knew he had been 5 years a prisoner of war. And when we knew he had been tortured. And when he spoke, it was believable to everybody that torture should have no place in the United States of America.
We're talking about the gravitas and the experience of U.S. Senator John McCain, who passed away Saturday. We're joined by current U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein as she shares her memories. And before we hear the second anecdote, I just wanted to ask you about yourself. You're facing re-election. Kevin DeLeon is challenging you now that there's the there was the open primary, two Democrats running against each other. Your feelings about having a Democrat running against you in this election?
Well, of course, it's what's called the jungle primary, and it was put on by a former member of the House of Representatives as a ballot proposition. And I remember talking to him at the time, and he thought it would be make the Republican Party actually more moderate in the state. But, I feel very good about it. I won 70% of the Democratic votes and beat my opponent in every single district in the state, including his own. So I don't take anything for granted. I'd like to continue to serve. There are things I want to do in health care and for public safety and particularly for fire. I'm very worried about the impact that global warming is going to have and the big fires that we've had when our fire season begins in September and October. And here we are burning, burning, burning all during the spring and summer. So, and we've been able to do some things like get 7 big planes to use in the fire. But I think we have to do much more and do it very well with our forests. To kill pests, to prevent the spread of fire, to enable its containment more easily, because we've lost, as you know, well over 1,000 homes in just the last few months through fire, and that should not happen.
And the loss of life that's come with that as well.
Correct.
Your opponent has portrayed that there's a big ideological difference between himself and you. Do you think that's true?
Well, I really can't comment. I can tell you what I'm for. Candidly, I don't spend much time on what he's for, but I work very hard to get certain things done here. And so I am ranking on the Judiciary Committee, and it's rather historic. It's the first woman to be there, and we have a very big Supreme Court hearing beginning next week. And so I concentrate on what I have to do and what I want to do in health care and public safety and the environment and particularly global climate change for California.
Conventional wisdom would say with the big lead you have in polls not to debate him. But I would love to moderate a debate between the two of you. Any chance I could talk you into it?
Well, let's see what happens. I'm not going to make a statement here and now, but let's see what happens.
And I'd love to close on the second anecdote that you were going to share with us about your colleague, John McCain.
Right now, I can't remember what the...
Oh, I'm sorry. I interrupted you between them. That's my fault. It's on me. Hey, Senator, anything else just to add about John McCain before we close?
A very important American has gone, but he was here for a long time. And his life was one of strength, and his life was one of commitment. He was a great patriot. He was a fine, fine United States senator, and he worked for this country to better it for 60 years. That's a pretty good record. And I just want to say, John, you know, it was a great pleasure knowing you. And I'm just sorry that our days are limited here, but you sure filled yours.
Senator, thank you so much for spending this time with us and talking about your late colleague and your memories of him today on Air Talk. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you.
Thank you. Dianne Feinstein, U.S. Senator from California, joining us to remember her former colleague. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, we continue with our memories of Senator John McCain. So many more guests to talk about. We'll also speak with former U.S. Senator from California, Barbara Boxer. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, back in just a minute. We remember John McCain on Air Talk today, and then coming up later this hour, another major loss. Neil Simon, a great American playwright, passed away over the weekend. I had the pleasure of interviewing him about 20 years ago. It's funny how so many people who are gifted with comedy are themselves not all that funny. And that's one of the things I remember about when I interviewed Neil Simon, is he was so low-key and not, you know, not tossing off one-liners by any stretch. Hard to imagine him as the man who wrote The Odd Couple, The Goodbye Girl, Barefoot in the Park. I mean, the list goes on and on. Lost in Yonkers, Biloxi Blues, so many major and beloved American comedies. That's coming up. We remember him later. Right now, we remember Arizona U.S. Senator John McCain. And with us, a gentleman who covered his political career for many years. He's editor and associate publisher of Arizona Capital Times, Luigi Del Puerto. Thank you very much for being with us, Luigi.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, share with us just what was it like to cover Senator McCain?
You know, the senator is irascible. He is. We've all heard about his temper and how that has become really a badge of honor. You can ask anybody who's worked for him or with him, and they'll tell you their anecdotes about, you know, that one day that McCain got upset with him. And like I mentioned, it's become a badge of honor. And it was you know, I covered his 2008 presidential campaign, and you know how profound his loss was when he lost that race. And, you know, obviously, we all have our stories about John McCain, and his death has profound implications, of course, for America and the rest of the world. But in Arizona, that the pain is truly terrible.
Yeah. And so how is he remembered in Arizona?
Well, he's remembered as this American hero with an outsized stature in American politics and on the global stage. You know, we have issues that are quite unique to Arizona. NAFTA, of course, is a big one, because we benefit more from NAFTA than other states. Immigration, of course, is a big issue for both our states. Water is another one. And I guess for many people here, the most important of all would be the fate of the military bases in Arizona. You know, John McCain is that calming presence in Washington, D.C. People here know or knew that with his presence over there, our interests are protected. In fact, last year when he was diagnosed with brain cancer, there were a lot of people who told me that it's the one thing that has kept him awake at night. You know, what happens if and when Senator John McCain passes away, who has the stature to take on the role of protector of Arizona's interests? And, you know, to put this into context, you have to remember in just a few years, we didn't only lose John McCain. You know, John Kyle, our other U.S. senator, is no longer in the U.S. Senate. Flake's resigning, so he won't be there next year. So we will have a completely new a batch of U.S. senators. And the question is, can they assume some of the role that McCain did for Arizona? And, of course, the hope is they would. And but of course, you know, it would take them years to grow into somebody like John McCain.
Yeah.
And for Arizona, that's just, you know, that's a big problem.
And a tough choice for Governor Ducey, who he's going to pick for the unexpired 2 years of the term. You have any gut level sense of who he might choose?
You know, the governor has been very adamant about not talking about it. Even now, he's saying, look, let's deal with it after the funeral services. But we do have a couple names that are being floated around. You know, John Kyle, of course, is one of them. You know, we've heard potentially Cindy McCain. We have the governor's chief of staff, a guy named Kirk Adams. I've heard from folks that maybe even the state treasurer currently, who is also an appointee, a recent appointee, her name is Eileen Klein. She's a very well-regarded public servant.
Okay.
The thing is that for the governor, you know, there are a couple of factors he needs to consider. One is that does he put in a replacement who's going to be a placeholder, somebody who's going to keep that seat and just sort of fade away after 2 years? So if he want somebody like that, he might, you know, the thinking is he'd probably pick somebody like John Kyle, who's been there, doesn't really need to be there, who knows the job, and who can assume that role and do a really good job.
But that wouldn't necessarily help the Republican Party in Arizona 2 years hence.
And that's the other question, is if he wants somebody who can keep the seat, yeah. So he needs to appoint somebody who can campaign, who has the stature, who has the support of the, quite candidly, the political establishment in Arizona, meaning the state chambers.
He's got a lot. Hey, Luigi, I'm sorry, I need to conclude, but we have so many folks joining us. Thank you. I really appreciate your sharing an Arizona-centric perspective on John McCain. Luigi Del Puerto is the editor and associate publisher of Arizona Capital Times. Also with us from Arizona, Doug Cole. He's a political strategist there and former staffer for the McCain 2000 presidential campaign. Doug, thank you for being with us.
Larry, thank you for having me on this very sad time for us native Arizonans.
And just share with you, have one particular anecdote or something to share, perhaps back to that campaign of 2000, which for you really captures John McCain?
Well, I could probably take up 2 hours of your airtime have your listeners in stitches at John McCain's expense. The guy was quite funny, and I think that's a side many people did not get to see. I was lucky enough to start with Senator McCain when he was a congressman back in 1984 in his Washington office. So I've been in the McCain organization for many, many years. It's like the old saying in Hotel California, you can check out anytime you want, but you can never leave. We are a very tight-knit bunch of people. But John was quite funny. We could be traveling in an airplane with Governor Brewer, for instance, in the 2010, his reelect in 2010, and we would be talking about what a scoundrel Vladimir Putin is and how he's just a dangerous man for the world. And then the next moment, he's talking about Jersey Shore and a tweet that he saw from Snooki. I mean, that was John McCain. He would walk into a VFW hall many times. This was a kind of a standard joke for him. And he would say, hey, how many here are Marines in the room? And, you know, McCain was a Navy man. And a chorus of hoorah would go up, and then he would look very somberly, and he'd say, you know, I think of you Marines often, particularly on Father's Day, and I pray for you because I know many of you never got to meet your father. And, you know, most people, that would just be a horrible thing to say. And, of course, people would pause and they start laughing. As a good Navy man, many times he would pick on a staff and say to the audience, "Well, I'm sorry, but, you know, look at Doug over here. Don't mind him; he's out on work release." You know, and people didn't know if he was serious or not. That's just the kind of levity and humor that a very serious international figure had, and it's a side many people didn't get to see. But more importantly, Larry, Arizona has always had an outside influence on the national and international political scene. We've had the Carl Haydens, the Barry Goldwaters, Ernest McFarland, who was the majority leader in the Senate before LBJ, Stuart Udall, Mo Udall, John Rhodes, who was the minority leader after Gerald Ford went and served as vice president. And, of course, Barry Goldwaters replaced by John McCain. We've had these outsized figures for the 48th state, little Arizona next door to you guys, big guys in California. And that's all gone now. It's going to be decades before anybody of the stature of John McCain enters the national scene on behalf of Arizona.
Doug Cole, thank you so much for sharing the anecdotes and the humor of John McCain as well. His interpersonal skills, legendary, and you gave some great examples. Doug Cole, Arizona political strategist, staffer to the McCain 2000 presidential campaign. Also with us, the author of John McCain, American Maverick, staff writer for Stateline, a Pew Charitable Trust publication. Elaine Espovich. Elaine, thank you for being with us. Elaine, are you there? All right, we'll try and get her on momentarily. Let me also bring into the conversation Bill Jones, who was California's Secretary of State, former Assembly Republican leader. He was John McCain's California campaign chair back in the 2008 presidential election. Bill Jones, good to have you with us again.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
And what for you, the most vivid memory of John McCain during that time of the presidential race?
Well, there's so many, as the other person that was on a moment ago said, and I could talk for a long time. But specifically, I think he was very attracted to young people. He had an ability, even at his age, to speak to a crowd of young people and really have them understand. I think it was probably because of his persona and his history, his war record, and that service above self is something that they should strive for. And I was always very much affected by his speeches to the young people. And furthermore, I remember right after the primary in 2000, where W. Bush beat him in South Carolina, and I think it was 3 weeks, 4 weeks later, we were riding a train up the coast of California, and he was speaking on behalf of then-candidate George W. Bush. And a lot of us felt very strongly that he had been treated poorly in the South Carolina primary, and John's attitude was, well, that's politics, that was yesterday, now we're moving on. And during that same train trip, I remember sitting with him, and a note was brought to him about his from his doctor about being diagnosed with this melanoma that happened to him on his face. And he looked at the note, and it didn't faze him. He got up, went to the back of the train when it stopped, and made a rousing speech for then-candidate Bush. So, you know, he was a patriot, he was a friend, and duty, honor, and country were what he stood for. And while I didn't always agree with him, I always respected him and considered him a friend.
Bill Jones with us. He was California's Secretary of State, and he was the campaign chair for the McCain for President 2008 campaign. He chaired the California campaign, and he had been one of the chairs of the earlier 2000 McCain campaign as well. So what for you, just briefly, was the biggest attraction to McCain versus the other Republican candidates of 2000?
Well, I knew the candidates, knew the candidate Bush. I was impressed with John being as genuine a person as he was. I thought that his, you know, not maverick status, but his willingness to speak up and look at issues differently than the average person and the average candidate attracted me to him. And then, of course, I think his unorthodox pick of Sarah Palin in 2008. It did stimulate the campaign right after the convention, and he closed on then-candidate Obama in the 2008 campaign, and he came close. So, you know, John, but he never lived in the past. He did not want to talk about the past. He wanted to talk about the future. And I think he was a true American hero. What I will always remember is his speech, even when he lost in 2008 in Arizona, getting up and talking about how we bring the country together and how we go forward together. And that was John McCain.
Bill Jones, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it. Thank you. Bill Jones, California Secretary of State, former Secretary of State, talking with us about John McCain. Of course, Later in his life, John McCain thought that he'd erred in choosing Sarah Palin as his running mate. Coming up, former California U.S. Senator Barbara Boxer remembers her colleague in the Senate, John McCain. We'll also talk with Arizona Republic columnist John Talton, who covered McCain and wrote about him during the period of the presidential runs. And we'll have a biographer of John McCain, Elaine Povich, with us. Plus, we will also play some excerpts from one of my several interviews with John McCain, one where he particularly surprised me and wouldn't answer the question that I actually asked him. It's Air Talk on KPCC, back after this live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdy's. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. As we remember the late Arizona Senator John McCain, who passed away Saturday, his death from glioblastoma, brain cancer from which he had been suffering for many months, but had actually returned to the Senate, was able to work between treatments until he simply got too old to go back and or too sick to go back and forth between D.C. and his home in Arizona. He was nearly 82 years of age and a very physically vibrant man, right up until the cancer took its toll. Well, I want to go back to 2005. I interviewed John McCain a number of different occasions. He's actually a fun person to hang out with. Sometimes he'd arrive early at the studio and we'd talk before he would go on. He's always curious to ask, oh, what's going on with you, and ask questions. Just he's one of those gifted politicians who'd make you feel very much like he's interested in you, wants to know what's going on. But he definitely surprised me with this exchange. It was during a member drive. John Raby and I were actually on the air fundraising. And then I went into the next portion of the interview with Senator McCain, this in 2005. And I asked him about the book that he was joining us to talk about, Character is Destiny.
I'd be glad to, Larry. Let me just, if I could, preface my remarks with my appreciation for KPCC and my appreciation for the fact that you have programs that I've been privileged to come on where we have an in-depth discussion of the issues. Too often today, they're a 30-second or 45-second or one-minute soundbite. And the reason why I'm hoping that people will continue to call in to 866-888-5722 is to make sure that NPR and KPCC gets the kind of support that's necessary. And I don't do commercials very well or very often, Larry, but I do think that this is a valuable source of information. And Ms. Myers, get off the treadmill and get on the phone.
Very eloquently stated, Senator. Thank you. That Ms. Myers was a listener who was talking about making a contribution. So very, very supportive. And that was not the only pitch. Later in that interview, he said to put him down for a $500 contribution to KPCC. But I also asked him about that book, Character is Destiny, and he talked about his experience in the so-called Hanoi Hilton when he was imprisoned as a POW.
I'd broken one of the camp regulations and was being punished by being tied up very tightly in ropes in one night. And much to my astonishment, a guard who we call these guys gun guards. They just sort of walked around the camp with a rifle. They were sort of like security. We never had much interface with them at all. And this guy came in and put his finger to his lips and reached down and loosened the ropes that they had me tied up in. And then a few hours later, when he was clearly his tour of duty was up, he came and tightened them up again without ever saying a word. And a couple of months later, it was Christmas Day, and I was allowed outside of my cell, and I was standing there and looking up at the blue sky, and this gun guard walked over. And he stood next to me for a minute, and on the dirt that we were standing on, he drew a cross and stood there with his sandal. And we stood there a minute, sharing a common faith, and for once transcended our surroundings. He rubbed it off and walked away. And I saw him many times after that, but he never showed any sign of recognition, but I'll never forget that particular moment on Christmas Day many years ago, far away.
our interview with John McCain from 2005, one of several over the years. My pleasure to be joined by former U.S. Senator from California, Barbara Boxer, who served from 1993 to 2017. Senator, thank you for joining us. Your memories of your colleague in the Senate, John McCain.
I have great memories. We had a very complicated relationship because we often saw things quite differently, as in the Iraq War. But we managed to overcome those differences and actually work together and get things done. After 9/11, we teamed up because he represented Arizona and me, California. The attack on our country was made with these long-haul flights, and so we teamed up to put air marshals on long-haul flights, which had not been the case before. We teamed up to do important things for veterans during this war that the Iraq War that I opposed and he supported. But we had some funny encounters. If you want, I can share some.
Yeah, please.
Okay. With John, and I write about it, I wrote a book, a memoir when I left, called The Art of Tough, and in it I talk about John McCain, like 5 pages worth of story. And when I first got to the Senate, remember, I served with him for 24 years. When I got to the Senate, there was a proposal for the government to start rating TV shows and movies, rather than have the Motion Picture Association do that. And coming from California and being someone who doesn't believe in censorship, I took the lead against this proposal. John was very much for it, as were the vast majority of my colleagues, I could say, Republicans and Democrats. And so after I made my speech about it, in my speech in front of the committee, he was the chairman of the Commerce Committee, I basically said, look, this is subjective. For example, I think Schindler's List should be seen by teenagers because it's such an important message about the Holocaust. And a colleague of mine, I said, a colleague of ours in the House, thinks it should be banned for everyone until they're 21 because there were scenes in the shower with naked women. So I bring that up and I say, this proves the point. Who's right? Am I right? Is he right? We don't know. This is subjective. Let's just leave the government out of it. After that hearing, I go to the floor of the Senate. I went up to him and I thanked him for allowing me to testify. And he blew up at me. And he said, you are banned from my committee. I said, what? Why? He said, because you quoted another person, a congressman, and he wasn't there to defend himself. And I know what that's like from the scandals that I've seen. And I said, John, I was making a point. He reiterated and got very angry because he has that ability to just turn on you. And so I was so insulted. And I started to leave the floor of the Senate. I was going to go up to the press gallery and say, how dare he ban me from his committee? When Joe Biden saw me, he said, what happened? You look upset. I said, well, told him the story. He said, well, just a minute. Don't do it, he says. Wait there. He comes back with a note from John, and he says, John doesn't mean anything, you know, by it. And John apologized. But we had, and we were able to work together. Remember, during the war years when I was so opposed and most of the country was for it, he saw me one day, and I was upset because the way war was going and Californians were dying. And he put his arm in me and says, Barbara, what's wrong? You don't look like yourself. I said, I'm scared about this war. It's just going on and on. It doesn't seem like it's ending. You said it would be, you said, John, and the president said it was going to be over in a few months. It's dragging on. He said, don't even worry about it. It's going to be over in a few weeks, at the most a few months. But he cared that I was upset. Anyone else would have just said, oh, you don't know what you're talking about, and turned on their heel. This is how complex he was. And we have had run-ins. We work together.
it was just a complicated, extraordinarily interesting relationship.
And it sounds like you had the Biden whisperer there the McCain whisperer and Joe Biden. It's funny.
Don't you say anything, it's just John. It's going to be fine. I said, no, I'm not. He banned me from his committee. It doesn't mean anything.
Barbara Boxer, thank you so much for sharing your memory of John McCain and what those tussles were like, as well as the interpersonal relationship of the two of you over the course of those many years that you served together in the Senate. We really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you. Senator Barbara Boxer, representing California from 1993 to 2017. Coming up, we'll talk with biographer of John McCain, Elaine Povich. I'll also talk with Arizona Republic columnist John Talton. Because of so many guests we've had coming in over the course of this hour, we're going to, so we can do justice to the life of Neil Simon, the playwright, we will talk about him tomorrow on Air Talk instead. Don't worry, we're not gonna miss a chance to talk about such a prolific and popular writer as Neil Simon. That'll be tomorrow on Air Talk. We continue with our guests in just 1 minute. We remember U.S. Senator John McCain died Saturday. He passed away in Sedona, where he lived in Arizona, surrounding by family. We talk about his legacy. Joined now by the author of John McCain, American Maverick, and John McCain, a Biography, staff writer for Stateline Pew Charitable Trust publication, Elaine Povich. Thank you so much for being with us.
Happy to.
So share with us your two books about John McCain. What attracted you to him as a subject for the books?
Well, there used to be a line that said New York City Broadway play that talked about one singular sensation. John McCain is a singular sensation. He is one of a kind, was one of a kind. He provided immense material. You know, when you write a biography about someone, they kind of move into your house and you live with them for however long it takes to write that book. John McCain moved into my house not once but twice. He was a welcome guest there, and every time we talked or I did more research on him, I found out new things about him. He is endlessly fascinating. You know, in this world where we have so many one-dimensional characters, he was a man of great depth and many facets, and he was endlessly fascinating.
And what do you think would be most surprising for people to hear about him that you uncovered either in conversation or researching his life?
I think one of the things that people forget about him was how much he knew about the world. He was immersed in foreign policy. He knew leaders from every country, from the newly independent republics of the former Soviet Union to the leaders of Myanmar. He traveled extensively every congressional break that he could. First of all, he visited troops that were deployed all over the world, but he also went and met with foreign leaders. There are people in countries that I can't even pronounce that know his name. And when he would show up, he would be a shining symbol of freedom and America. And they looked to him, no matter who was president of the United States. You know, people who are unsuccessful presidential candidates usually don't get great accolades. This man does, and it's not just in this country, but all over the world where people recognize his name and know what he stands for and stood for.
Back in 2008, that presidential run, those running against him, the campaigns would talk about his temper, raise questions about, you know, his emotional stability. How did he respond to that sort of negative talk about him as a person?
He got angry. No, he didn't. Look, the thing you have to remember about John McCain is he did get angry. He exploded. He used to yell at reporters all the time. But as you heard that story from Barbara Boxer, he didn't really mean it. He just blew up. And then, you know, a few minutes later, he would calm down and say, oh, well, come here. What was that question you had again? Please let me answer it for you. He never stopped answering questions. I could ask him anything. What's your favorite movie? Viva Zapata. really? What's your favorite book? For Whom the Bell Tolls? He would answer almost, I think, every question we threw at him.
Yeah, and there was even an effort to stump him. I can't remember one of the shows about your favorite poet, and he just from memory starts reciting the poem that that he said meant the most to him.
Well, it was probably something from Robert W. Service.
Yes,
and
it was.
The Ballad of Dan McGraw, I think. And that was one of the things he recited when he was in the prison camp in Vietnam for all those years. One of the things that he did to entertain his fellow prisoners was to put on plays from memory, things that he remembered from school. He would recite poetry from memory, things that he had stored up in that vast mind of his. And he would provide some kind of entertainment for those poor men who were being tortured and kept in otherwise horrible conditions.
And fascinating to see his the enmity between President Trump and John McCain. President Trump tweeting his condolences to the family. White House staff apparently, there are reports they wanted to get him to talk about McCain as a hero, and we didn't get any of that. And clearly this went both ways. Quickly, your sense of McCain's view of the president.
Well, you have to understand that John McCain's life is all about service, service to others, service to his country, all about something greater than he would say than self-interest. It appears the president is a lot, if not entirely, about self-interest. And there is the fundamental difference between the two.
Elaine Bovich, thank you for joining us. We so appreciate it. John
Happy
McCain.
To be here.
John McCain, American Maverick. Her most recent book came out a few months ago. John McCain, a biography from 2009. Also with us, John Talton, who was an Arizona Republic columnist from 2000 to 2007. He's a fourth-generation Arizonan. John, thank you for being with us. Quickly, your thoughts on the Arizona legacy of John McCain. John, are you there?
I am here, Larry, and thanks for having me on.
Yeah, what's the Arizona legacy of McCain?
Well, I have to emphasize I'm a former columnist to the Arizona Republic, but I still write on Arizona issues. John McCain was a very substantial and important national figure who made his base in Arizona. He did very little for Arizona as far as bringing in federal funds, as far as bringing in research dollars, transit, things like that. That was consistent with his conservative philosophy. Arizonans, most of whom are not from there, love him. It's important to remember that while McCain is an important national figure, he shines all the more brightly in comparison to Donald Trump in the White House. Now, John McCain assiduously cultivated the national media, and so they always fell in love with him and perpetuated the Maverick myth. He was a fairly conventional conservative. He was capable of enormous errors in judgment, being willing to place Sarah Palin a heartbeat away from the presidency.
Which he admitted later in life was a serious mistake. John, I'm sorry we're out of time, but John Talton, thank you very much for sharing it. And a very interesting point about the lack of federal dollars coming back to Arizona. But that he didn't pay a political price for that because of all the transplants. John Talton, who was Arizona Republic columnist for a number of years. From all of us at AirTalk, have a great afternoon. Fresh air is next.